Cheryl, nice to be back. So, as always, I am opening the floor, you could call it, to your questions. This is really, satsang is really about you. It's about your true nature and anything that's in the way of your seeing that. So if there's anything at all that you would like me to speak about, to explore, you can either raise your hand and or type a message. And if you raise your hand, you might want to type in that I raised my hand, so because sometimes I don't see the little hand raising symbol. And I'll give it a moment here in case someone is typing. And of course, if you don't have a question right at this moment, that's fine too. You can raise your hand anytime or type anytime during the session. And as I always also point out, you can email me in between satsangs if a question comes up during the week and you think, oh, that'd be a good question, and I'd like to hear what Nirmala has to say about that. Then you can just send it to me at nirmala@endless-satsang.com. And I'm not seeing any questions pop up yet, so I probably will go to a question that came in via email this week. And again, feel free to interrupt. I might even, if someone does pop up with a question, I might even stop and answer that one first. Just because I like it to be, it's nice when the question is in the moment, when the question is something that's actually happening for someone right now, or it's a burning question right now. And so that's also, that's the correct email, but you don't need a www in front of it for email. It's just the nirmala@endless-satsang. Close though. It'll work as long as you get the www off. All right. So the question that came in email is actually a follow-up question to question that I spoke about last week. And the person writes, thanks so much for answering my question related to maintaining a connection to the heart. And she was, just to recap, she was equating feeling connected to her heart with feeling the opening or expansion of the heart that naturally happens whenever we experience a larger truth, whenever we experience more of what's real, more of what really matters in life. More love, more peace, more joy. There's a sense of expansion, opening in the heart, or another way of saying it is in our sense of self. That's where we most directly sense our self as true nature, as presence. And so it naturally expands when we're experiencing more. And I pointed out that when the heart contracts, that's actually the correct response when something is limiting or shaping our experience of the moment. And so just like when you go in the store and try on a sweater, you want a small sweater, a sweater that's way too small. You want it to feel tight so that when you put it on, you maybe even before you get it over your head, you realize this sweater is too small and you put it back and take a larger sweater. You want a small truth to feel tight, so that you recognize that it's small. That's actually the functioning of an aspect of your true nature, which is discrimination. This capacity to know how true things are. And big truths feel big, small truths feel small. And again, what feels small, strangely enough, is your sense of self. That's what contracts. Because it's your awareness, which is also a quality of your true nature, that naturally contracts around a small truth. So anyway, she goes on and says, I clearly needed to remember that any connection, not just an open heart, works. Yeah, so I stressed that she could really, really trust the contractions of her heart. She could also really trust the expansions of her heart. the times when her sense of self opened and expanded and softened and relaxed. But you can trust it when your sense of self contracts, because that's the right way for a small truth to feel. So she says, I'm using the acronym WTC, which of course is a lot better than WTF. But she's using WTC, welcome, trust, and curiosity to remember, which is helpful. So she just created a little reminder that helps her come back to. I like especially the trust and the curiosity. Both of those imply staying connected with the actual experience you're having in the moment, in your sense of self, in your heart. No matter where it's going, no matter where life is going, you trust that either expansion or contraction that happens in response. And so then she goes on to say, after I quit trying for an open heart, I found when I checked with the heart that it often seemed neutral or quiet. I don't know if I mentioned that last week. I think I did, but that's another correct response of the heart, is that if there's not anything shifting, if there's not much really shaping or limiting or expanding your sense, your experience in the moment, then if you check in your heart will basically just be at rest. Often if there's a willingness to stay with that sense of neutrality, you could call it, then it will very subtly, very gradually open up, because the expansion of our heart is really more like gravity. So it's kind of like if you really relax, you might find yourself kind of sinking back into the chair. I'm doing it right now as I speak. So that is gravity taking over because my muscles are relaxing. So there can be a subtle expansion, but without something really presenting itself, you know, showing up in the moment through what you could call grace, there may not be a big expansion. And then another time when the heart can be very neutral in its response is when you're considering something that really just doesn't matter. Another way of saying this, rather than saying, you know, what's true, a bigger truth opens your heart, is saying that when you focus on what really matters, it opens your heart. And when you focus on something that really is a small thing, if you focus on it, if you get stuck on it, then there's this sense of contraction, because your awareness is focusing, contracting onto that small thing. But there's also this kind of place in between where if a kind of neutral thought, like if right now you just notice what color the ceiling is in the room that you're in, that's usually a fairly neutral experience. You know, unless you have a lot of preferences about how decor should be done, and you think that all ceilings should be black or something like that. And the ceiling in my room is a neutral off-white, actually the same, almost the same. No, it's actually a lighter color than the walls. And so I can notice all of that, and I don't really experience either a contraction or an expansion, because it's not only, I guess what you could say is it's a very, very small truth, but it's not actually capturing my focus, because it's recognized as irrelevant, as not mattering. And so similarly, if you are using your heart to try to make a decision, you may find that actually, like if you're trying to decide whether to rent this apartment or that apartment, or you're trying to decide whether to have soup or to have salad, then you may find out that they're equally true. And so there just won't be that much difference. And you may also be discovering that it really, really doesn't matter. You know, in the greater scheme of things, even a fairly big decision like which apartment to get, especially if they're two great apartments, it just might not really matter. And life will go on no matter which apartment you take. Life will go on whether you order the soup or the salad. And so that's I think that might be one thing she's experiencing, is that without much going on, the heart can often seem neutral or quiet. And then she says, so I would then return to an outward focus fairly readily. So if she chucked in her heart and there wasn't much going on, she would just get busy again with the world, with the outer experiences. And she saw a notice I put up on Facebook about a free online satsang call that Neelam, my teacher, was having last Sunday. And she went to it. And she says, I needed her reminder of the basics of presence, the turning inward, including toward any sensations, such as the connection or boundary where the body is connecting with the world, like the ground, the chair, even the air around your body, the connection, the boundary between your body and your clothes. And she says, I'm finding that seems to help me maintain a more inward focus and to more readily access the energy in the heart, which was eluding her or evading her. So it was like she kind of, Neelam gave her a new kind of practice that wasn't so much looking for, it's just, you know, going inward with the question, is my heart opening, is my heart closing, she instead was just going inward into her more inner experience and specifically using sensations as a doorway to turning attention inward. So it's kind of like going inward with less of an agenda, less of a specified inquiry, but just going inward to find out what it feels like inside right now. So she says, so as I currently understand it, although we do not need to change or fix our state of awareness, we do need to remain in presence to be connected to the awareness. And she says, any further advice on maintaining connection to presence, inward rather than outward focus? So I'll answer the very specific question, any further. It's kind of like, are there any other means of staying connected to presence? And basically that's what all spiritual practices, or most spiritual practices, are really about, is turning attention inward. Whether it's meditation or inquiry, following the breath, mindfulness actually can be kind of interesting because it includes both inner and outer sensations. But because it includes inner sensations, it is like most spiritual practices in that it brings us more in touch with inner experience, just relatively inner. Anything, you know, from the boundary that we normally call our skin and inward, including all the way into more subtle dimensions that also can often feel like they're located inwardly. It's actually an arbitrary direction, especially when you get to these subtle dimensions. But in general, spiritual practices and spiritual pointers and spiritual teachings are designed to bring a more of an inward focus. And so really any practice that really resonates for you, that really seems to be working for you, I would say go for it. You know, if Neelam's suggestion of focusing on sensations. You know, one of the things about spiritual practice, there's a lot of things about spiritual practices which I've spoken about on here before, but one of them is that often when they're fresh, there's a kind of, that is the best word, there's a freshness to the practice when you first hear about it and when you first try it out. So it can be very, very rich at first. And that's great, you know, go for it and enjoy it. And they tend to, you know, there tends to be a little bit of a been there, done that quality that comes after a while, and it's like, yeah, feeling my sensations, okay, you know, and it doesn't have that same, like, wow, I never really was that present to the, you know, to the feeling of my feet on the floor and my body against the chair, and you know, even the more external experiences of like sound and sight are actually registering in your body. And so, you know, the first time you get pointed in this way, the first time you are, someone describes self-inquiry to you, or just simply points to awareness, asks the simple question, what is it that's aware of this voice? What is it that is aware of the body? And those pointers, when they're fresh, when they're new, can sometimes be very, very powerful just because of that newness. And so, again, in direct answer to her question, you know, any and all spiritual practices, meditation is probably one of the most important ones to at least explore and try out and give a shot to meditation, because it can take you so far inward. And I just I'll make another quick comment about meditation. And again, I just want to remind anybody that you can raise your hand or jump in anytime, even if something I say triggers a question for you. But just one real practical thing about meditation, which is something I've just learned within the last few years, is that there seems to be a much more profound effect when you meditate for an hour or longer. It's, you know, sometimes a very challenging thought to some people to actually sit in meditation for an hour if they're used to doing, you know, like a 20-minute or a 30-minute meditation. But this is, by the way, based on recent neuroscience research. It's actually based on people observing the brain during meditation, that there's a definite shift in brain activity that happens after about 45 minutes. And so if you can stick with it, you know, and set the timer for an hour or longer. The hour kind of gives you, it's roughly 45 minutes, so the hour gives you a cushion. You may find that, for instance, you may find that an hour a day, sitting for an hour continuously, is better or more effective than doing 2 half-hour meditations. And just in general, that longer meditations have more impact, have more effect. They can take you more deeply into an inward focus. And so, all of that being said, you know, this is one of my favorite topics, of course, is spiritual practices and meditation and all the whole range of spiritual practices. But I'd also like to speak some about spiritual practices in general. And as any of you who have been listening know, I tend to talk about things on many different levels. And this is another case. And, you know, the reason for doing that, like a simple little metaphor, is what happens when you're driving on the highway and there's a big mountain in the distance that you're headed towards. And it's just true that our experience depends on where we're experiencing from. Where are we at in the moment? And so as you're driving towards that mountain, there's this simple thing that happens. The appearance of the mountain gets bigger and bigger. Right up to when you're going right past the mountain, it gets as big as it's going to get. And then, of course, as you continue past the mountain gets smaller again. As you look at your rear view mirror or turn your head, that same mountain starts getting smaller again. And so the size of the mountain is really dependent on where you're looking at it from. And this is kind of, as I said earlier, it's kind of like the reverse of the old Zen saying that first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. In my little metaphor, first there is no mountain, then there is, and then there is no mountain. So it's the reverse. But the principle is still the same. It all depends on where you're experiencing from, what direction you're moving, and where you are. So when we apply this very, very simple metaphor to spiritual practice, there's this question, like, what is the role of spiritual practice? Does it work? Is it worthwhile? Is it necessary? Is it important? And the answers to those questions all depend on where you're experiencing it from. And if you, as the questioner this week, spoke about this contrast between an inward and outward focus. You know, if you're like most people on the planet, if you're basically caught up in your outward focus, if you're caught up in the daily experiences of your life, then, you know, any practice that turns you inward, practice that is inquiry into your emotions or an inquiry into the nature of thought can be very powerful, because it's bringing into view a whole other dimension of your experience, of your existence. And so at that point, and for quite a long time in the spiritual journey, these pointers, these practices, these processes that bring your attention more towards what's inside are just appropriate. They're what's needed in that moment. But when you, it's kind of a weak metaphor, but when you reach the mountain, when you start to have ongoing or strong experiences of your true nature, you may not need the practice to keep your attention there. And even as you move past that level of experience, then spiritual practice may become less important. It can always still have a place, because no matter how expanded, how enlightened someone is, there are moments where the world tricks us. The world hypnotizes us, in a sense. And so a simple, gentle pointer can still be of value. And the reason I'm speaking about this is that some non-dual teachers, because of where they're at, because they've gone way past the mountain, their teaching is that the spiritual practice doesn't matter, that it just reinforces the illusion of a doer, and therefore, just forget about it. Just go hang out at the bar, and if you're meant to awaken, you'll awaken. And of course, there's an element of truth in what they're saying, because the main force, the main factor, especially in a profound awakening, is grace. And yet, it's not really relevant truth. It's not really appropriate to someone who's still still approaching them, still looking, still seeking, you could say. In that case, it's relevant, it's appropriate to teach spiritual practice, and also teach discrimination around spiritual practice, help someone find the spiritual practice that really does specifically open their heart, that does specifically work for them. So even in this question of whether you're on the right track with your spiritual practice, you can listen to your heart. You can notice what impact it has on your consciousness directly in the moment as you're doing it, and in the times when you're not actually doing the practice, what effect is it having in general in your life? And so, I was also maybe going to use the metaphor of how if you're learning to play the piano, then it's important to have these kind of periods of focus practice. But then when you get better at playing the piano, sometimes you can sit down and just play the piano. And so again, that's as the spiritual journey unfolds, you can reach a point where consciously practicing, you know, doing a spiritual practice isn't so important. Instead, you just play. You just enjoy life with possibly a full sense of the inner and the outer. And then here's where it gets really interesting, because what's different about spiritual practice relative to these kinds of concerns about how to, you know, bring my attention more into the present moment, or how to be more in touch with presence. What's different is that what you're practicing, what you're attempting to accomplish or do, is already happening. It's a very paradoxical activity. It's so different than, you know, learning to play the piano, where the first time you sit down and play the piano, you're not exactly going to be virtuoso. You know, there is a process of development, something that gets added to your skills that make you a better piano player over time. But you can't actually get better at being present, because you already are. So if you really take a step back, all spiritual practices are kind of like the equivalent of doing something in order to practice having shoulders. That's a very paradoxical activity, because you already have shoulders. They're there whether you do the practice or not. They're there whether you're consciously aware of them or not. Shoulders just are. And so ultimately your true nature just is. Awareness is here. I challenge you to try to turn it off. Try to get away from awareness. Where would you go? Where there's no awareness. And so practicing turning inward towards presence is a very paradoxical activity, because presence is here whether you turn inward or not. Presence is here whether you're conscious of it or not. And presence is functioning whether you're turned inward or not. And so that, you know, we think that somehow this practice is going to add something to our experience that wasn't there before. And yet, surprisingly, when you practice enough, it's like if you practice enough doing something to have shoulders. You know, maybe you do a lot of shoulder rolls, or you go to the gym and you do a lot of weightlifting involving your shoulders, or yoga stretches that involve your shoulders, or you get a massage to bring attention to your shoulders, or you massage your own shoulders, and you do all those things. What can happen is a greater conscious recognition that, oh, that's what shoulders are like. That's what shoulders can do. That's what the muscles inside the shoulders feel like when they're being massaged. And in that is a recognition of that shoulders exist, that shoulders are present. But the practice didn't make you have shoulders. It's not like until you go to the gym and start lifting weights, you don't have shoulders. Now, again, I said this is where it gets tricky, because even spiritual practices, and also using this metaphor, you know, you can, of going to the gym and exercising your shoulders, there can be sense in which you improve or increase the functionality of your shoulders. If you lift weights, your shoulders will get stronger, and they will function, be more functional. but they won't exist. They won't start existing because you were lifting weights. They exist before, during, and after any exercise program. And again, like I said, this is where it gets tricky. Our spiritual practices and our inquiry, and I would even include, any processes that develop you are more subtle levels, than just building muscle, but are more subtle levels of strengthening or clarifying or purifying your personality, your psychology, just the way you are in the world. Anything that is out there that can improve your functionality can be valuable. Again, before, during, and after any spiritual awakening. It's not like your shoulders stop being functional when you have a full realization that shoulders are always here. They still function, and they still function to varying degrees depending on how flexible you are, depending on how strong you are. And so, this, again, it's where it gets very tricky because the real core of spiritual awakening, spiritual realization, is the simple realization of the depth of the breadth of your true nature. But again, it doesn't cause you to become that. You already are that. And then within that, there is also this ongoing question of, you could say the question of how do I live my life? How do I function? How can I be more effective in my relationships, in my career, in my work, in my health and well-being? It always is less important question than who am I? Always is a secondary question because without a recognition of the nature of, I tend to really wear out metaphors, but without a recognition of the nature of your shoulders and the way they naturally move, then you're probably not going to be as effective in increasing their. They're not going to accomplish much in increasing their effectiveness. So you might, do exercises that are not actually very helpful, that you can actually over-tighten certain muscles and not develop a full range of motion. Again, I wear out metaphors. So when you bring this to the question of our spiritual life, it's a question of balance. Because if you get overly involved in trying to improve your functionality and lose track of what you already are, then you can become a full-time professional seeker. You can become a full-time attendee of every psycho-spiritual workshop and process and learn every spiritual technique out there and still not realize this kind of radical transformative truth that what you are is not a person. What you are is beyond any concept. This is where even the metaphor of the shoulders really falls down, because what you are is not a thing. What you are is not a separate self. Those are all part of the functioning. The concept of a separate self, the identity as a separate self, is part of the functioning of your true nature. But it does not contain your true nature. So again, if you get overly involved with self-improvement, it's a pitfall. It can be kind of a trap. Because you go round and round and round, and you can't ever seem to, it's all relative. It's all part of duality. So no matter how hard you apply yourself, it's always kind of a mixed bag, the results that you get. Anything you do to improve yourself will also annoy some people. You know, if you become supernaturally happy all the time and learn to act that way all the time, it will really annoy some people and seem insincere to some people. It's just part of duality. And so you can overemphasize that part of the equation, you could call it. And then, strangely enough, you can this happens with, as people start to experience their true nature, you can overemphasize the bigger truth. You can overemphasize the experience of your true nature and try to pretend that, therefore, you know, how you function doesn't really matter at all. In Zen, they call this the stink of enlightenment, the stink of Zen. When someone has such a powerful experience that they are not this individual, separate person, that they drop all concern with how they act or what they do. There's like no involvement with that. Which, strangely enough, is often actually a means of escape or avoidance. It's a way to avoid the practical, relative individuality that still exists, even when you realize that you are much more than that. If it truly doesn't matter, then why not also address the means, the possibilities for improving the functioning of your individual self? And so that's the balance view, is when you've gone so far past the mountain that you realize the perceptual nature of it. You realize that the mountain only exists when you're up close to it. The mountain only exists when you believe in it, when you focus on it. But you also recognize that you are free to go back and climb the mountain, or go back and visit your friends back on the other side of the mountain, that you don't have to avoid the practical, functional level of existence. And so that's nice when it can be a true balance, a true flexibility. And, you know, it'd be nice if this was sort of automatic. And in a sense, it ultimately is. Because what really brings about this experience of balance is greater awareness. When you recognize yourself as awareness, that often frees the functioning of awareness. It allows you to be, if you're just pure awareness, it's okay to be aware of, say, a strong feeling of contraction or sadness or depression or anything like that that appears in the body and in the mind. And you don't need to move away from it because you are awareness. And in fact, awareness is the antidote. Awareness is the healing force in our existence. So I said it would be nice if there was if it was something that just happened automatically. And yet again, even that, there's this, because what we're dealing with is so subtle and so and because the mind is so tricky, it's you know, the ultimate best conclusion is to not have a conclusion about what role spiritual practice has or doesn't have, and how much you need to work on yourself and how much you can just relax and be yourself. To not have a conclusion either way. It seems that it's out of that open-ended, undetermined, flexible approach to things that says, well, you know, I've been past the mountain, but I'm going back now. Or, you know, I've gone back and now I'm done hanging out at the mountain. I'm going to drive away again. It's like the ability to flexibly explore your true nature and flexibly explore and possibly challenge and question and transform your personality, your individuality. And both of those are welcome, in a sense. When both of those are included in your awareness. Again, it's, so what you do is include them in awareness. What you do is welcome them into awareness. You don't have to do anything more. Just as when you finally become totally aware of your shoulders, you get it. Oh, I don't have to do anything to have shoulders. I can just welcome them into awareness. And then that's all, that's it. I've accomplished having shoulders just by noticing them. And that is obviously true with this question of our true nature. It's always here. It's always present. It is just simply this aware presence that's always present, always aware. And so awareness of it is really all that's needed. And then surprisingly, if there is a fullness of awareness, that's actually what does transform and improve and resolve any limitations relative limitations in our functioning, in our actions as a human being. In our humanness, you could say. It's when we're really, really willing to be present to them that their nature is revealed, that they are recognized for what they really are and what place they have, what purpose they have, what functional purpose they have. A good metaphor for this recognition of where things fit in your inner experience of being human, of having, you know, sadness and anger and all the whole wide range of human experiences besides the experience of true nature. A good metaphor for that is when you have a clear seeing, a clear discrimination of a particular tool. So a simple example is the hammer. The hammer is a very useful functional tool for specific activities. For, you know, driving in nails, for smashing things. If you really need to smash something, you go get a hammer. If something won't budge, you might go get a hammer to knock it loose. And then beyond that, this very useful tool that probably everyone on this call probably has one or knows somebody they could borrow one from because it's sometimes so useful. But beyond that, it's like the clear discrimination of the nature of a hammer means that you don't try and use it for everything. You don't try and brush your teeth with a hammer. You don't use the hammer to change the channels on the remote control. You don't use a hammer to open a jar of pickles. And because it's not very functional. It's not a bad hammer. There's nothing wrong with the hammer, but you try and brush your teeth with it, you'll find out it's not very functional for that. And you probably will incur some dental bills if you get carried away with the hammer. And so that is the nature of all aspects of experience, all aspects of our humanness. They all have a place. Turns out awareness, in a sense, sits on the throne. Awareness has the biggest purpose, the biggest functional capacity. Awareness is like this amazing, you know, I don't know if you've seen these little tools that have like 20 tools all in one. You know, it actually has a hammer and a saw and a screwdriver and a knife and everything all in one tool. Well, awareness is like this amazing multi-tool that affects everything, that is central to almost all functioning, and probably to all functioning. But then other aspects of our experience are just as real in an ultimate sense, but not as functional. So I've been only 1995 for shipping and handling. Yes, that would be the ultimate sales job, is to sell someone their own awareness, including shipping and handling. It's often so obvious when someone experiences, has a big experience of awareness. Like, oh my God, this is it. It does, in a sense, fix everything. It does it. It's like the most amazing multi-tool you could ever buy online. And yet, there are these specific aspects of our experience. And all the way down to the very human experience of feeling sad, or even, I guess, ultimately something like shame or apathy or grief. Though there can be aspects of our experience that are incredibly small, incredibly limited, incredibly narrow in their functionality. And yet they still have some. Better examples are things like fear and anger and pride, which are still very small, very contracted states. And yet they have more functionality than, say, apathy. Apathy might, a good example where apathy might function well is when you're dealing with a wild animal where the best thing to do is play dead. if you then just kind of like say, oh well, if I get eaten, I get eaten. Like if there's a big bear sniffing you and you've heard that the best approach is to play dead, then, get pretty dead. You can get totally apathetic, and that's might help you be more passive in the face of that threat. And then, like I said, in contrast, things like shame is a similar thing. I discovered a long time ago that if I act a little bit ashamed when I get pulled over by the police for speeding, that I'm much less likely to get a ticket. they seem to want that response from me. And so if I act sorry that I was speeding and like I was wrong in doing so, that's better than arguing with them or threatening them because I don't want to, in that case, anger is not actually very functional. But in general, anger is a much higher energy state, and there are times when you need that energy to protect yourself, to set clear boundaries. And so, the most important thing is awareness, because that's what puts everything else into perspective. If you're being very aware of your own anger and very aware of the effect it's having, is it actually having the desired effect? Is it actually functioning in that moment? And of course, like I said, anger is more like the hammer. There's a few things that anger is good for, and then a lot of things that anger is not really good for. And so if you start being curious about your experiences of anger and what are the results, not just, in an absolute sense of moving into the ultimate truth of your being, but in a practical sense, in a functional sense. And then as you get to know anger, it can naturally, it's just like when you really know how to use a hammer and what it's good for, you naturally go get one. When it's like, oh, you want to hang that picture? Here, let me go get the hammer. And you know when to put it back in the drawer and forget about it for 2 months or 6 months because you don't need a hammer. And the same thing with anger. It can kind of take that place. And if there's also this curiosity about awareness itself, you can start to discover how that, in a sense, improves the both the functionality and something even, it's a strange thing to call it improving, but a curiosity about awareness itself, again, it comes back to that idea that spiritual practices are like trying to do something in order to have shoulders. That as you get more familiar with awareness, then there can be these moments of realization that, oh wait, that's always here. That's what I am. This body is just one more tool, you could say, in the tool drawer. This mind is just one more tool in the tool drawer that I can pick up or put down. But awareness isn't a tool. Awareness is something much more profound, much more meaningful, much more true. And so all the way back to this question of spiritual practice, it's as there is a greater and greater realization of your nature as awareness, of the ever-present quality of awareness, that spiritual practices are not have become less necessary. Spiritual practices themselves are like the tools in the tool drawer. They're incredibly effective, incredibly helpful in certain circumstances, at certain points in the spiritual journey. And yet, again, to wear out another metaphor, you know, even when something like the hammer is really good for driving a nail, but to be effective, that you need to know when to stop. Because, you know, if you're tapping in a nail and you've got it right, you know, tap a nail put into the wall just right so you can hang a picture on it. But you just keep hammering on the thing, you know, you just keep wailing away on that nail. Pretty soon all you're going to have is a hole in your wall. And it's, again, not a bad hammer. There's nothing wrong with the hammer. It's just with greater awareness, being more present to the effect the hammer is having, that you know exactly when to stop so that you can hang a picture on that nail. And so the same thing with spiritual practice. The most important, probably the most important in aspect of all spiritual practice, of the whole spiritual journey, is to pay attention. She said, welcome, trust, and curiosity. Those were her reminders. And so this is kind of emphasizing the curiosity. Really paying attention to what effect the spiritual practice is having. It's the nature of, just like the hammer with the nail, it's the nature of all spiritual practices that not only is there that initial blush of freshness and excitement when you discover a new spiritual practice and find it so profound, but there's also a built-in natural limitation into anything you do, anything that you approach with that attitude of doing, that means that at some point it will be too much of a good thing, or at some point it won't really fit anymore. And so to notice, is your spiritual practice still evoking or causing, it's hard to say causing, but it's inviting more awareness, more presence? Is it actually bringing you more experiences of the full range of your being? Or at some point, paradoxically, does a very effective spiritual practice seem to be causing the opposite response? You know, you can overdo it with any spiritual practice, and it will be like continuing to hit the nail with the hammer until there's just a hole in the wall. There will be an overall experience of contraction. The overall effect on your experience day to day will be one of numbing or reducing your awareness. If you overdo it with meditation, it can become just a way of numbing out and not actually a way of opening awareness. And then it all depends. It's all unique. It's all individual. So, at the end of this question that I received, she asked whether do we need to remain in presence or focus on our sensations, which is basically what the practice that she is given by Nyingma. Do we need to stay to focus on our sensations in order to be connected to awareness? And it's actually the right question, because it's not a question you need. It's not it's not that cut and dry. It's not black and white. It's always like, well, let's see, is it working? Is it working right now? Is it actually achieving that outcome? And at times, an overemphasis on focusing on your sensations. I remember, I think it was Adi Shanti once talking about how mindfulness, again, if you overdo it, it's a powerful practice, and yet if you overdo it, you can become sort of like, it's a strange thing to say, you can become hyper self-conscious, where you can't, eat your toast in the morning without this like over and compulsive, extreme, awareness of my hand lifting the toast and the toast approaching my mouth and now biting the toast, and now the sensations, all the little sensations of the toast in my mouth, and now chewing, and then, saliva, and then it's all mixing in my mouth, and then swallowing happens. And it's a powerful practice to be that aware of your sensations. And then at some point, it can become a trap. It can become a limitation. Yeah, somebody wrote that sounds burdensome. At a certain point, any practice that you become attached to and are not willing to let go of is itself its own kind of trap. So just like the mountain, we approach these things, we experience them, and ideally we wear them out. Ideally we use them up. I had a friend years ago said that spiritual practices are like Kleenex. He went so far as to say the best approach is to use them once and then throw them away, like a Kleenex. I think that's a little extreme, but you get the point. All right. Speaking of knowing when to stop, it is time for me to pass on the microphone. I will ponder the question, Cheryl, about today's title and type it in a few minutes. And thanks all. It was a real pleasure, as always, being here. Take care.